our conversations, and we feel sometimes we're getting a little bit closer to what we want to be talking about. We're doing the preliminaries and we're getting through to it. Now, one way of extending the conversation would be for me to pick at some of the lack of communication or problems I'm having. And one of them is about the idea of the avant-garde.
You just said lack of communication.
Yeah. Well, I wanna pick at something which I don't feel that has been left obscure or is standing between us, which is getting in the way. I want to get rid of it so that we can talk properly. And I want you to tell me what you think of the concept of the avant-garde. Because we both unite and we get quite enthusiastic when we delve into something like Finnegan's Wake, the most avant-garde book to have been written. And when we talk about Wyndham Lewis, whose paintings were so avant-garde, they were rejected by the avant-garde of his day. He was an outsider and a painter who was kind of the enemy. He defined himself as the enemy of the painting scene of his day. And we like those things. And yet, you seem to not credit some of the cultural things I refer to as being avant-garde and of having pertinence today. And I want you to just tell me what you think of the concept of the avant-garde and whether it's historically dated.
Yeah, it's those arts, painting, music, sculpture, installations, concept art, different kinds of literature, to me don't have any staying power. The one Zappa concert is worth, you know, four visits to the Metropolitan Museum or to the Whitney in New York City. I don't get anything now. I listen to the Dumitrescu music. There was two samples on the Wire magazine that I found, one by him, one by his wife. And then I listened to what you played on your the 27th, I think. Last week, October 27? I don't know. Anyways, last week. And yeah, because today is the 28th, so it had to be the 21st. I enjoyed it. The live concert you played on your show was more powerful than the excerpts in The Wire, because it was bigger or something, louder. But immediately I wanted to hear Zappa's synclavier, that dog noise, the meow, 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 that he would do in the 88 tour. You know how he'd make funny noises with the synclavier in the 88 tour? Do you remember that?
I was listening to that and thinking it was like a criticism of... Well, it was like a rubbishing of the sampler. It was using the sampler for the silliest sounds you could find, and there'd been so much pretentious garbage done with the sampler since kind of Brian Eno and people had kind of sampled noises and then repeated them over the keyboard in that kind of breathy, atmospheric way, that he seemed to be going out of his way to find the most ridiculous sample he could possibly make, belches and strange body noises, and then have them played as sheer jokes. And I found that exciting, because it that moment of rubbishing of the respect and awe that people can generate at the touch of a button through technological pieces of apparatus being made fun of in that way just struck me as brilliant, as where we need to start from. We need to start from the rubble of all these mechanisms given for us to communicate with each other, because we have to build it up anew. We have to build it up in a way that makes sense for us. But this sentiment of mine, for me, is avant-garde. And so I want to know whether you think this, the things that you admire in Zappa, I would describe as an avant-garde assault on people's sense of thinking that they already understand what culture is delivering to them,
and that he assaulted the official avant-garde.
And you see, quickly, please, yeah, do.
Those sounds that he made, it really shows you that he was a really good ear and a comedian of sound. Just like his guitar solos were so pleasurable, he then makes joke sounds, and they're luscious, they're fantastic, and so I was thinking those samples, and I was thinking, where is that in Dumitrescu's work? You know, I haven't heard enough. Does he go like Frank? Does he get that funny sound in there?
Well, I think he does, because of his seriousness. One thing I like about the kind of electronic music done at the Columbia Princeton Center in America and done at the Cologne radio station in Germany, 1950s hardcore serial electronic music, is the way it almost unconsciously imitates body noises, and that because they're so intent upon pressing through the boundaries of compositional possibility, they lose a certain guardedness about what sounds are allowed, and you get things which are like enormous stomach rumbles happening in Stockhausen, and I've always really loved that. I thought that it had a kind of purity. They're not caring about decorum anymore. They're not thinking of music as something that you wear a wig and you know, the whole of classical music is dominated by the 18th century and its wigs and little chiffon in a wrist array, it bursts through that, and I feel Dumitrescu does that. He's after some kind of cosmic biological orgasm in sound, and he's going to pursue that whether or not it sounds frightening or ridiculous. So I do think it has it, but what I want to say is that I do think there's an avant-garde. I do think there are various things, and I'm not too bothered about whether they're written in a book or communicated on a computer or they're sounded in a concert hall or at a rock gig or where they're manifested, so much as what effect it has on my attitude towards mass media. That I'm interested in these things as critical moments which make me reflect on what everything is doing. Now, if these things don't give me any information about that or change how I see it, but merely feed a need I have to walk through art galleries, then I'm afraid I don't have any need to walk through art galleries, and I'm bored stiff, and I'm against it.
Okay, so didn't out of the avant-garde of the last 40 or most of the 20th century, wasn't one of their main messages that art is everyday life, what's going on around you? I mean, definitely Cage tried to show that in noise or in sound. So I find the avant-garde in my daily life in all kinds of unpredictable, unclassified situations.
Yeah, so it's like a door has been opened, and why don't we walk through it? Why don't we act?
And I walk through it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I don't look for avant-garde. I guess basically what I learned from the avant-garde is there ain't no avant-garde, there's no art. Look at what's going on and try all different ways of looking at what's going on. That's why I recommend, you know, McLuhan, Zappa, LaRouche, Croker, Thompson, all these different sources who don't agree with each other. But I like to put on their view. Right, this is years ago. Now I'm bona fide, you know, got my own ability to hallucinate. But I did this for decades, explored things without a point of view. So I would get points of view in response to what I was engaging in, but everything was available. There was no lack. There was abundance of insight everywhere. Like McLuhan said, this art critic came in and says, it's rather depressing today, isn't it? And he says, no, I find meaning everywhere. I find meaning everywhere. And what is meaning? I find inspiration. But I do fall back for extra input on Zappa, McLuhan, Croker, William Irwin Thompson, Krishnamurti, Dr. Peter May, Russell Lynn LaRouche, and a few other things. But that was in the 80s and 90s. Now, they're gone. And I'm in charge of creating that inspiration for other people. I'm now Zappa, is the way I look at it. I have to wake up the people so that they can notice, in a sense, what's going on in their life, where the art is. So I just see avant-garde institutions as propped up by the Rockefellers or corporations. It's a welfare state for overeducated people. And they make nice art, but it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't mean anything. They're just telling me the same message I already got. I could say, I got the message, Mr. Duchamp. I understand you. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. I got the message, Dumitrescu. You know, I don't need to be reminded of that. But I enjoy, for the transitory effect, listening to Dumitrescu's music. I never heard it before. And it sounded pretty powerful, the live thing that you were inside of. But it was a lot of explosions. Then I was thinking about how Zappa says you create some dissonance and then you release it. And I was thinking, well, Dumitrescu was going loud and then it was soft and then loud. Now, that's based on 10 minutes of listening, you know, and not informed. But that's, I don't get, it was fun, but geez, you know, I got lots of other stuff to listen to. Oh. And like you played Hank Williams, you know, that's, okay, there's Hank Williams. I haven't listened to him in 10 years. All of a sudden I'm listening to him. Oh, that's interesting. Then your comment, you know, and I'm just consuming. It's basically data consumption, and I can take it or leave it.
Oh.
I can take it or leave.
Yeah.
So
I suppose that's where,
to figure out whether I'm attentive or not.
Now, I don't think I agree with you about that, and I want to explain why. And I'm not sure it's whether because I'm not as evolved as you are, and that I haven't quite gained the summit of the mountain, or that I'm just a bit more conscientious about differences in the material that you're dismissing so grandly. That what you've said I completely agree with from an experience I had today. I went to the Wallace Collection, which is a famous 18th century collection of art. Is it 18th century? I don't even know which century it is. And it's in Manchester Square, just off Oxford Street in London. It's been recently been refurbished in the modern style, where they've given up trying to pretend that classical paintings are great works in the modernist sense and hanging them on white walls, and now they recreate 18th century drawing rooms. So you go in and there's chandeliers and amazing wallpaper and gilt clocks, and they brought back all the furniture clobber, which seems to have been, you know, kept in storage for the last 70 years or so. They put it all out again and recreated 18th century drawing rooms, absolutely stuffed with paintings. And all very
like
well
theme
lit.
Parks, mini theme parks.
Yeah, it's, you go back in time and you admire all these gorgeous artifacts, and painting is just one of them. So it's no longer trying to do the art history thing of saying that painting is a special art of something in a on a canvas, and it doesn't really matter about the frame or anything else. It's about perception, and there's a history of it, and we go from the Middle Ages through to the Renaissance, and then we have certain decadence, and then we have realism, and we have Cézanne and the Impressionists, and on to modern art, and that sort of history. They've kind of given up on that because it's more popular. People want to see chandeliers and kind of chintzy rooms, and it's all centered around a very posh restaurant with a maitre d'oeuvre standing there and a little menu in a gilt frame as well, and you can go and have your expensive glass of wine or expensive coffee, and there are little flunkies cutting up strawberries for you to consume. And that's the new way of presenting the old art. And the interesting bit for me was the modern art section, where the Brit Art leader Damien Hirst has his new exhibition. And Damien Hirst, having been the king of post-serious conceptual art, where suddenly conceptual art was accessible to the masses and entertaining and sensational, the first exhibition here of with his art in that hit the headlines was called Sensation, organised by Maurice Sarchi, the guy who brought you Margaret Thatcher, did the advertising campaign for Margaret Thatcher, so he's worked for the Tories, big advertising guy, loads of money, and he essentially created an art movement through the media and advertising and I mean, I'm sure you know this story. It's a famous story.
Yeah, I do. I know.
But Damien Hirst has now done a return, he's decided, to painting. Having done all this conceptual stuff before, he's now going to do painting. And so exhibited at the Wallace Collection, you've been through all this 18th century painting and all these valuable objects. Damien Hirst is presented as the most valuable modern artist that we have today. And what you get is things that look like a first-year undergraduate doing his impressions of Francis Bacon, that he's doing skulls in squares with darkness to shock, and they're terribly feeble. I mean, Francis Bacon still, if you see a Francis Bacon on the wall in a gallery, can give you quite a turn. It looks like people's faces are being turned inside out because he was interested in flesh, and he makes you look at it again, and it's a shock to see his paintings. And these things by Damien Hirst, if you pass them on the railings at Regent's Park, where people sell cheap, you know, do pictures sort of by the dozen and sell them to tourists, you wouldn't, you know, notice them. I mean, it's an incredible poison chalice which Brit Art has given the bourgeoisie. They need art, painting to invest in, but the actual quality of what they're doing has gone so downhill that it's kind of amazing. Now, what you're saying about the irrelevance of paint and canvas to any kind of real, you know, if you look at the big picture, any kind of contribution or any kind of relevance or pertinence or anything that has the weight of what Cézanne once meant or what Rubens once meant, then I'm in complete agreement with you. You know, it's a fantastic analysis, what you've said, of something like Damien Hirst. But I think there's a huge difference with something like Dumitrescu. I don't think Dumitrescu is trying to do a music to fit in with classical repertoire, that the equivalent of Damien Hirst are the people writing music, Michael Nyman, writing music for people who are trained to do Baroque music, and then they can do his music very easily, and it can be played at expensive picnics, and everything fits. That I think Dumitrescu is working with sound in a way that's new, and that we need that kind of research because it gives us our point of view for looking at mass media and for analysing it. And without that connection, essentially, with what the avant-garde is doing, because all the names you cite tend to be writers, apart from Zappa, they are theoretical writers. And I think we need a sensual experience which is qualitatively different from what mass media are doing. And if that's found in the concert hall and everything, I'm not bothered. I don't know where it comes from. I'm not prejudiced.
All right. I just want to say that I started talking about those people 25 years ago on CKLN in Toronto. And it was all new to people. They didn't know them, and it was effective. But I was part of the Queen Street art scene. I was all over the place and taking in the James McDougalls of the area. And so that, what I just said is not what I was advocating, not limited to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I did what you did, what you do. I go to the galleries, look at the mainstream stuff. I do it quickly, no big deal, get the hell out of there. You know, it's nothing. But I check it out, or I look at the people there. I study the audience of it. But I'm doing the situationist thing, you know, walking around looking for, what was it they called it? You know, you look for geographical hidden places.
They had derives. They said the most interesting thing in the city is the city itself. So this gazing at artworks in galleries is kind of ludicrous because we ought to look at the city itself. And I'm in complete agreement with that. But I'm interested in what can make you look at the city. I'm interested in what can cause you to look objectively at what a modern city is, to see it with a historical eye.
I did think, as I was listening, these are atoms, or this is a street landscape. I did think he was talking about today.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? I feel that there is something being reflected. It wasn't even music. It was just showing the clash and agony and tension and sublimity of it all, of something. And what's interesting, because it could be the view of a electron microscope, it could be a telescope, it could be someone on the bus in the subway. It covered all the environments. In other words, it was catching up and redoing Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, well, I think there's elements of that. I mean, I'm finding Dumitrescu is focusing my thoughts on freedom and necessity and basic philosophical questions, and that the way I go out to thinking is by artistic experience. I trust artistic experience in a way I don't trust concepts. And I used to use, I still do, Finnegan's Wake and Zappa as that, and I'm kind of wanting to include Dumitrescu in, because he's doing something with the classical orchestra which is telling everybody they aren't allowed to play the notes they've been trained to play. They are not allowed to go through all the things they've been trained to do so well. And it was somebody who isn't a classical music fan who pointed this out to me, who was sitting with me, who actually likes Irish folk and Irish rock. And she said, that flautist is not allowed to play all the notes that she spent 10 years training herself to play. He's not letting her, because he's making them only play expression. They're only allowed to watch him, and the kind of notation he's using, and he needs a lot of notation to get them to do what he wants, isn't about notes. It's all about something else that he wants them to make happen in that room at that particular time. And suddenly my vision of Dumitrescu was of a sorcerer, of a James McDougal, of somebody who is making a room come alive, and he happens to want to do it with all these people who play instruments, but he's making something occur which is making all of us kind of realise how beautiful a huge racket can be, that everybody's being told to make a huge din on their instruments, and then he's shaping it. He's not just saying make a din and that's it, in that sort of rather like the Duchamp urinal, or like various noise people who do something extreme and then rest on their laurels. I did something extreme, it's a new concept. I find that very boring. But he makes all this noise, and then he tries to ride it and shape it and make something of it in the room for you at that time. And I find that...
Are you saying there was no electronic effects going on?
No, he uses electronics. He often has a computer playing electronic contributions during the playing.
And there's actually an orchestra?
This is what I love about the music and why I think it's made for CD. In fact, I almost prefer it on CD to seeing it live, because it's... you can't tell what kind of music it is. That when you're listening to it on CD, you ask people, well, what is it? And they can't tell. It's noise, it's sound, it's... So he's somehow, by using the traditional route of composition and classical players, he's reached the music which a lot of people have been looking for. I mean, a lot of the 80s and 90s, everyone from John Zorn to Butch Morris to Derek Bailey talked about, how can we get a music which is beyond genre? We don't want to be stuck within playing in these boxes. We need a universal music. Where are we going to get it from? And suddenly Dumitrescu arrives and he appears to be doing it, you know?
So there was an orchestra.
Yeah, there's a straight orchestra sitting there, and there's a conductor, and there's people clapping at the end, you know.
Well,
the traditional framework.
10 minutes, maybe I didn't hear. No, I heard most of, I think, what you presented in the show. Maybe not all of it.
Yeah, well, I cut off the applause because I don't want to bring it back to the classical rigmarole, because I think it matters too much. I mean, I think Dumitrescu's music should be put online and made into a virus and sent to explode on people's computers all over the world, because I think it's up to that level. I don't think that it's needs a special kind of a listening where we put on a periwig to listen to it.
I don't know what I was listening to. I thought I was hearing a synclavier kind of stuff or something, or electronic tapes, or digital. No, hardly any orchestra, I thought I was listening to. So that's pretty good. I didn't even know what I was hearing.
Yeah.
I put a rear view mirror image in. That's why I said, well, this is the Zappa sound. But these are sounds that an orchestra is making that Zappa never got made.
Because my point is, I mean, I don't want to turn you into me, although in some ways, because I'm turning into you, I do want you to turn into me, otherwise there won't be any me left.
Yes.
That, you know, I think that your idea of the avant-garde artists dissolves themselves into all the possibilities of new media, and the way you consider yourself beyond the avant-garde artist who's still delivering pictures somewhere or what have you. I admire that and I agree with it. And I think, in fact, Frank Zappa was telling me to be that when he said to me, let's record your book as an album, you know, made me go into the recording studio. I was thinking about that the other day and I thought, ah, that's what Bob does. And Zappa was saying I should go that route, that the audio is a completely different level and a new form of communication that we should use. Now, I don't want you to stop that, and I think it's a great leap, but I kind of want to hang on to keeping one's radar open to anybody working, and often they're working in ways in which they're not going to come and explain to you conceptually or reasonably what they're up to, but that the actual sound of it or the actual look of it will strike you. And that I want, I want an appreciation and keeping open that moment for the subaltern creative person. And it's something that Frank was always very good at. That, you know, suddenly he was using Bruce Bickford, or he was pointing out Nicholas Slowominski, or, you know, that these people who the pop world had never heard of and wouldn't hear of, he kind of said, well, there's something there, Wild Man Fisher, whatever it was. So I think we should keep that up as well.
That serendipity. He would find, and McLuhan talked about Joyce writing that way, just waiting and watching, and then finding the slips of tongue that were epiphanies. Now, that's the way I live, and I know I'm watching and looking and active because I found you and Duma Trisco.
Aww.
I wouldn't have found it if I hadn't met you. You know what I mean? So I found out about Duma Trisco. Nobody over here in Maui probably don't know about him. But now I'm the only person in Maui who's experienced a little bit of him. But I definitely want to experience more. Because you're saying there are a bunch of penguins in bondage there making that music?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, he's frustrated with them. And I had a conversation with him and I was saying, well, why should you should use free improvisers? Of course, he has used free improvisers and he knows what that is. But of course, they are so far away from interpretation of anything written down that he can't organize them to do what he wants. So he needs some new kind of musician. And in fact, it's that process of trying to make new musicians that you're watching while it's happening, which is why it's transformative and exciting. What the real excitement of the music actually is his decision to re-educate those musicians in front of you as an aesthetic experience. So you're seeing how we need to be transformed, how our whole education has been wrong. That's what you're experiencing. That's why it's orgasmic. That's why it's amazing when you see this music, because you're having a revelation that all the things you've trusted and all the systems that you thought were valuable that would make you more articulate and a better person were actually going in the wrong direction, and that you need a new system that will actually bring out what your personality is into the public realm where it can shape something beautiful. That the suppression of your personality and learning the disciplines and by rote which suppresses that actually produces a grey misery, and that the golden beauty of orgasm is expression, and it's a personal expression, and that this can become public. I mean, this is the freak out side of it. Frank Zappa was very inspired by the freaks and what they wanted to do, and I think what the whole idea of the freak out was that you could have a collectivity that wasn't based on suppressing the individual.
Yeah, that's an experience I'm hearing. It's almost like I'm watching Obama go into politics and try to change the world. Here you have Duma Trisco decides to go back into the ridiculous world of orchestral music and shake it up. It's a noble aim. It's a puny old institution, but it does have archetypal intensity for young people as they grow up and experience the heritage of Western culture and all that. They got to have this guy correcting what they thought they learned from their music school in high school or whatever. But it's, does he do other stuff? Does he get in the demonstrations with you? Does he will he get on and talk to a medium? Will he do other strange things other than this music? Is he just a specialist?
Well,
it's a phrase. McLuhan had this phrase, specialist cures for specialist ills. He specialized in music and went into the specialist ills of the orchestral scene and shook it up. That's good.
He's definitely a specialist. He and Anna Maria Avram, his wife, have studied what musical instruments can do with incredible intensity. They're interested in all the vibrations and freak notes produced by individual instruments, and they're working out relations and things which are not certified, which in fact the score system and the Western system of notation has suppressed. Now, Ari Albrecht, the French music theorist, says this is because they come from Romania and they're full of Eastern sounds and gypsy sounds and things from outside Europe. Traditionally, they play traditional Romanian music as well, though not in public that I've seen. And that this special relationship to Western tonality is what enables them to be so at ease with this completely new explosive kind of sonority. So in a way, it's like the blues or something. It's that they've found some way of getting out the straitjacket of the usual Western tempered system. Now, philosophically, for me, this leads on to questioning everything that, from that musical basis, you can say is questioning Western reason, is questioning the money system, is questioning the political system. But it's early days yet for us to recruit him to our particular revolution. He's extremely open to dialogue. His English isn't great. My Romanian's non-existent. We unite in pidgin French sometimes. Anna, his wife, speaks good English, and we're at the moment beginning communication, and that's what's exciting for me, because having grown up in Romania, I mean, he suffered the Stalinist regime. He has a lot of resentment against the terrible regime of Ceausescu, and obviously he celebrated when he was killed in the way that we all did. So he has prejudices against Marx because he feels that that gave a seal of approval to the regime, but he's interested in my arguments that in fact there can be a kind of Marxism that can have a dialogue, say, with a McLuhanite like you, and he's looking for allies. He's coming to Britain and playing his music, thinking that he'll find allies in the classical world, and then he's finding the only people that support him are, in fact, Chris Cutler and his Recommended Records operation. Chris Cutler was the drummer in Henry Cow and has supported avant-garde rock and avant-pop for decades, and Resonance Radio. And so it's actually these people who come from counterculture, or, you know, not the official system, that like him. And so he's gradually learning that these are his allies. Now, when he played at a Faust festival outside Hamburg, he said to someone called Andy Wilson, who supports his music, I've found my audience. So he is looking for an audience. This is part of my excitement with his music, that if we could virally spread it via the system we're using to communicate with people, I think we could change him and change us.
Yeah, we create new music from him. Mm. Response.
I mean, Tim Hodgkinson, who was also in Henry Cow, puts it, he isn't another example of the knot in modern music. He's untied the curse of modern music. And that, for me, is the crucial thing. I've always believed that actually Edgar Varèse, that Frank Zappa taught me, that modern music and Edgar Varèse are actually a fantastic, pleasurable release and not a punishment. Modern music is presented to everybody as a dreadful punishment you have to go through. It's a punishment for the repressed, but not for us. For us, it's a liberation. And I think because Dumitrescu is that, we should use him.
Yes, so how many people were at those concerts?
They were the usual. Yeah, less than that. I mean, we're talking about 30 people or so.
30 people for several nights, right?
Yeah.
30 people, and would he be written up in whatever classical music magazine?
No,
there?
He's been ignored.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I had a contact because I supported a bass player and composer called Simon Fell for a long time. I asked him for a contact. So there's the Radio 3 producer who produced Simon. So I sent him a CDR. Of course, absolutely no reply. They're not the way Richard Thomas at Resonance put it to me. Well, those people, they've got their agenda all the way through to 20 years beyond their own deaths. They know exactly who's coming up and who ought to be there. They don't want to be bothered with some Romanian with noisy music who puts pictures of volcanoes on the cover of his CDs, you know. Who is this guy? You know, it's music for our people. It's not music for the classical establishment.
It's not music for the undead. It's
yeah.
People who are sort of alive.
Yeah.
Sort of. We're only sort of alive.
Yeah.
Then.
Good. Well, I seem to be managing to explain to you, because I have a concrete example and I can play it to you, I can actually sort of move the conversation on a bit, not just sort of disagree theoretically about avant-gardes. And this, for me, Bob, is real practical discussion, such as I've had at the best times throughout my life, where if you disagree with somebody about something, then you play the record and you have a, you know, you discuss it. Yeah. And I've usually found that in a room with a bunch of people, everyone knows whether the music sounds good or it sucks. It's very rare that you end up in a situation where everybody is saying, well, you know, usually you have to admit you've got this brilliant record and that you think's brilliant. You put it on, and everybody says no. You turn around and say, "Yeah, I know what you mean. You're right." You know that music creates a collectivity and an agreement, and it's the lack of that sort of discussion which leads to the camps in music and the separations and the kind of miserable, "Oh, I'm a folk listener. I can't listen to that." And all that thing that any Zappa fan has to be totally against.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to take James McDougall to one of those concerts.
Exactly. That's exactly what I like to do. I'd like him singing with the Dumitrescu band.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we need to move towards.
The energy of it, what I heard, and I'm going to have to listen to more of it, reminded me of one of my great experiences was Ornette Coleman in Carnegie Hall in 1973, September. Can you know who Sonny somebody was playing guitar, maybe?
Sonny Sharrock, yeah.
Yeah, that was the beginning of that phase, and that was pretty explosive. And there was a guy up in the back, and he just had a T-shirt on, and he was screaming like a maniac all the way through it. So eventually the ushers ran up and were chasing him around, and he just kept screaming. I agreed with him. The energy unleashed by Coleman was, he felt like you had to scream along with it.
Yeah, yeah.
They chased him. I don't think they ever caught him, but he was not a nut. He just wanted to say that. That was his response.
Mm.
And they didn't like that. They thought, the ushers thought it was disturbing us.
But that's absolutely my reaction to great music, is needing it to be an event and trying to scream at everybody and unite them. I mean, yeah,
start
maybe.
Laughing. You just start laughing. All
yeah, time. Yeah. I mean, it does make you laugh when you hear the truth, because it's such a relief, you know, against the kind of the humdrum insistence that everything has to be boring, that everyone marches in line to tell you, and that if you don't agree with that, you're some kind of naive person who needs more education, and you haven't realized yet that everything needs to be boring.
Yeah, you could. That what I heard could be played at a demonstration.
It sounds like demonstrations. It sounds like riots.
Yeah. So is it generally always like that, or does he have whole different kinds of acoustic atmospheres?
You see, I'm talking about him, and it seems funny to talk about him and not to his face, but we have to do that because we have to speak our minds in front of our audience, and our idea is that we do speak our minds. And so I think, as I say, I think he's developing, I'm developing. And one of the things I want to say to him is that what produces the dull patches in his concerts is when he's doing the game, which is the trying to promote yourself as a classical composer. And what you do is you write a piece for solo clarinet, you write a piece for piano, and then the very good instrumentalist finds it challenging, and then they include you in their program, and then the critics have heard of you, and then they write about you, and you get slightly bigger and you get a commission. And this is what most modern music concerts are. They are really boring acoustically, in terms of your ear and music, because they're all doing these deals with impressing each other, with writing for the different instruments. It's like demos. I don't mean demonstrations in the street. I mean a demonstration record or an audition or something. And these kind of concerts are absolutely tedious. I would only want to see Dumitrescu with a full ensemble, with the computer noise, with everything. Give me everything he can for as long as we can take it, you know, until we're rioting in the streets. That's what I want. That's what he should be doing. But this, so that's my answer to it. He's reaching there, but he has these other plans, ideas. He needs to survive. There is a certain pragmatism involved with being an artist, you know. But me and Andy Wilson, and Andy Wilson is a fellow revolutionary. He was a full-time organizer for the Socialist Workers' Party for 10 years. We want to help him reach his true revolutionary role. That's what we want to do. And I mean, we've gone very Dumitrescu in this program, and that's okay because we've hours to talk about everyone else too. But the real reason I brought him up was simply to, as one example of things which ordinary people dismiss to me as avant-garde. It's not reaching many people, but I hope that you would could see the point of.
Oh yeah, no, and I'm just beginning with them. I could pick up the energy, which shows you know, I'm an artist because I can respond to it.
Yeah. Well, we feel at home. We know where we are. This is the stuff. I mean, when I was a critic, I nearly actually did my brain in by having to deal with all the stuff that isn't like that all the time. You know, it drives you crazy. This is why there are very few music writers you want to read, because their everyday existence is spent informing people about things that they shouldn't be informing anybody about. They should forget them, you know?
Yeah, I'm reading because Scott Wood sent me some articles, old articles by Richard Meltzer and somebody named Frank Kogan and Grail Marcus. And I just think of these guys having, as in the late 60s, early 70s, they had to consume the regular stuff to survive as early rock critics. And that wouldn't be worth it. Robert Christgau, how does he go for 50 years, whatever, 40 years, listen to scrap? I think it's a drug for them or something. It's odd.
It's amazing. I mean, as soon as you become an expert, I mean, Guy Debord reserves, I think, his most venom for people called experts. And I think partly the date he's writing in the 50s and 60s, that the expert was often called on TV and radio. It was a sort of new thing. And it's precisely the expert you shouldn't listen to about music. Yeah. If somebody says they're an expert on jazz, you know that they're not going to tell you anything honest about their responses. They're trying to rise up this disgusting pinnacle of arse lickers, you know, to the top of this.
Their own image they got to play on.
Yeah,
and authority. It's a terrible. Actually, I agree. Rockism is stupid. You know, the whole thing was crazy. But I can understand it's an effect of our media environment. But just doing it defeats the whole spirit of rock or whatever was going on or still going on.
Although I should throw in something against that, which is when I grew up in, which is after the golden age of the underground press, which I did read when I was 12. My brother had copies, and that was my initial inspiration, Oz and International Times, and the kind of writing in there which allied music journalism with tirades about society. You know, I loved that.
I also read
New Musical Express in the 70s. Yeah. And actually something very interesting happened in that magazine. Before punk broke, it developed into a ball of negative energy. It spent its whole time denouncing everything that the official record labels were releasing. I don't know how they managed it. It was very strange. They had advertising from the labels, and they spent their whole time complaining that it was rubbish, you know? And punk was kind of produced out of that contempt for the average product, which produced that rift that punk rock was.
But they liked punk rock, though.
Yeah, they promoted it. I mean, that was Charles Chalmers' baby, you know.
And they had a way to beat up Frank.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they had. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they used it to throw the baby out the bathwater, and suddenly you had to pretend you hated all jazz and all rock and everything, and that you'd never listened to anything before, and you were a complete nihilist. Otherwise, you weren't cool. And then that went with accepting any kind of novelty that had a rock and roll beat or a disco beat that was coming your way, and quickly,
so what were you
going
to say?
Went
you
wrong.
Were saying that you,
but so yeah, yeah. But reading this,
for the guys who made fun of it as they were doing it.
Absolutely. I mean, see the Seething Wells, the recently deceased great Seething Wells, was an example who always produced this kind of. Did you ever come across Seething Wells as a critic?
No, I've never heard of him. Where do you
go? He joined the Socialist Workers' Party as well as me, but he was more famous than me. And he produced.
Where did he write?
Well, he was on TV, and he was a character within, you know, the rock criticism. But whenever you saw him, there was something kind of absurd about his honesty and the bluffness, which was inspiring. You know, he didn't fit
better
quite.
Better than Rodney Bingenheimer.
Yeah. Yeah,
is it
probably.
Better than Rodney?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah.
Mayor of LA, you know.
Oh, is he now? Oh, right.
No, he was called the mayor of L.A. or Sunset Strip. Right. No, he wasn't technically the mayor, but he was an enthusiast, you know, from the late 60s and stayed in the rock industry and looked pretty plastic. But is it seething like that?
No, that wouldn't be. Maybe, although I've never been very fond of Lester Bangs because I've never agreed with his judgments, but someone like that.
Okay.
Maybe. I didn't really want.
So we're talking about rock criticism, and there's a channel. It was the way people, New Energies, could write, and there were great writers.
Yeah. And all I wanted to, when I was reading New Musical Express in the early 70s, all I wanted to do was be a rock critic, because they seemed to be the only people capable of thinking about what's going on in media, commercial culture, and having a position in which they could make observations and personal and political remarks about it all. They seem to be the only people capable of bridging the gap between some kind of personal integrity and the money-making machine. Everyone else either seemed to be a drone within the money-making machine, or so personal that they were quite outside it and they were very nice poets, but they weren't really looking at what everybody's going through. They were no longer in touch. So the position of the rock critic seemed very, very attractive to me in the 70s.
Who was the first rock critic? Who was your early model? Who were you inspired?
Well, probably Charles Shaw Murray, because I had the school kids Oz, and he was in there. There was a photograph of him, and then I noticed he was writing for New Musical Express, and I liked the way he was very committed to the Rolling Stones and Muddy Waters and understood the blues, and I liked the way that he could suddenly see the point of punk, even though that wasn't his generation.
Then don't you eventually started to criticize him, I think.
Yeah, I have my disagreements with him. I hope I have a dialogue. I'd like to have a dialogue with him more than just disagreements, but I enjoyed his book on John Lee Hooker.
Have you met him?
Yeah, I have met him a couple of times.
And he knows how you write?
Yeah, I mean, he wrote a review of my book on Frank, which was, what's the word? Polite,
you know. You putting him down in your post space, you know.
There are, you know, I put everyone down in my post space. That was function. But I just wanted to make the point that, you know, that rock criticism, that stultifying thing of having to keep abreast of every new bit of garbage being shot out the machine, is kind of totally disgusting. And why would you ever want to go near it? On the other hand, I mean, I like the sensitivity of your remark about how music can still function in the young person as this awakening moment, you know, that observation. And similarly, good music writing, I think, can help cultivate that. The where the hell it is at the moment, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the blur. So, we've got... And when I say blur, that doesn't mean I'm being postmodern. Mm-hmm. It's a fact. We are living in a blur. You don't like the postmodern response to it.
Yeah. Well, am I in a blur? I mean, I'm trying to be as clinical and clean and accurate as I can. I'm hoping to carve opinions which have a clarity and keenness which will attract other people to me.
I'm not saying that we're blurred.
Yeah.
We're reacting to the blurring effect.
Yeah.
And seeing through it. I claim that I can see through the blur. And you claim to see through it.
Yeah.
And you would like other people to adopt those formulas, so to speak.
Yeah.
Of how to see it.
Mm.
How to see through. But we have Dumitrescu. He has to be a rock critic to the degree he has to make those little classical music things to get a bit of credit so he can survive. I mean, could he continue and then go work in a factory or something so that he didn't have to make those little classical compromises?
Well, I think it would require social revolution. I think it would require Bob and Ben syndicated, on every radio station, everyone listening to us, everyone talking like us, everyone expecting art of such cosmic and personal majesty to arise every day as a natural environment for us to live in, not some kind of special occasion, but actually the ether that we breathe. This is breathing. This is actual life. I mean, we're only going to have, I mean, I know you're immortal and everything, Bob, but my line is we are only going to have one life, and we need to live it now. And
yeah,
I'm impatient.
BBC demonstrating every day with the lousy program.
Exactly. We need actual life now, that we need to live now. It's the demand for us to live now. Because I've accepted the fact that I'm going to die, I've decided to demand to live now. And that's really where I think we unite, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I intend,
since I'm going to be here forever, I'm going to enjoy the now. So it's all now for me now. But no, I like that idea. You know, people go out and demonstrate against Brown or something. They go home and watch TV. No!
Yeah.
Demonstrate against whatever TV show.
Yeah. Well, you. I was
that
like...
Be more real.
Like,
more
well, real. Yes. Yes. Because we must connect what we really want with politics, and the normal way of answering
and
that.
And not protest these shows because they're politically incorrect.
Yeah, not at all. It's because the music's bad.
It's aesthetically stupid.
Yeah, absolutely. But this is, we must have a politics which proceeds from what we really want. Now, the usual way of putting that down is to say, yeah, but what everybody wants is money. It's as simple as that. And so, but once you say that, then everything's lost, because that's the system that we have now. And I'm proposing a different set of standards, which are not... We need economics and we need money to finance ourselves, but the money is abstract. Music is absolutely concrete. Music and sex are real. You can touch them when they happen. They are actually living. Money is always everything postponed.
I just thought of something. McLuhan said you need to turn off the TV environment every, you know, for a couple months, have a media fast. We need to stop them. We should have demand to stop the money system for 6 months, and then do that, whatever that leads to. Then bring the money system back in for 6 months. You know, that's actually a new form of financial ecology. I never thought of that before.
Well, we could bring it back as gambling or something, you know?
Yeah, or just a little bit. You know, give it a say. Let it. I used to say, you know, these endless arguments about whether you abort or not, you know, pro-life, pro-choice and all that. I said, well, the government should have total abortion allowed for 10 years, then have no abortions allowed for 10 years, and then we can contrast and compare.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's always been a problem.
Like that.
Well, Bob, there's always been a problem with controlled experiments with medicine, hasn't there? I mean,
not medicine. I'm saying as a social policy.
Yeah, well, with social policy, with humans.
4 years of socialism, then 4 years of laissez-faire capitalism, and then vote on what the results were, how we felt in it.
Well, did you ever hear the story of the Emperor of Germany, Frederick Stupormundi? Who was a very wise man in the Middle Ages, an incredible king, had a kingdom from Germany all the way down to Sicily, dealt with the Pope, fantastic man, very well read. He wanted to find out what language did babies actually speak before they started speaking the language of their parents or their nurses. You know, what was it, Hebrew, or was it Greek, or was it Latin? You know, what will they naturally speak before they get diverted into all the kind of dialects that everybody speaks? So he did an experiment. He had 10 children brought up, and their nurses were not allowed to speak to them. Mm. And all the children died. So this is the problem with answering social questions with experiment. That, you know, the because it's controlled from outside, it actually has harmful effects on the people you're doing it to.
Wait a minute.
I think of Tuskegee. You see, you remind me of the Tuskegee experiments.
And they've all died. So we're doing them whether we claim it or not.
Well, yeah.
Do it consciously.
Yeah. I mean, you've heard of the Tuskegee experiments, haven't you?
Yes.
I mean, which is the basis of Thingfish, is a kind of extension of thinking about that.
Applied to AIDS.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's true.
I mean, you know, it's a problem with dialectics. It's a philosophical problem of treating people as objects, you know, and people are not objects. So you can't experiment with them in that way, observing the results.
Scientists, but you can experiment them as a public action, experiment with reality. I think, Ben, you need to take this show to the streets. I want you to start organizing whoever is listening to have demonstrations occasionally against whatever's going on in there in the media.
Yeah. Well, probably what we need is some kind of...
And I can Skype in. I'll Skype in and join in.
Okay, well, we need some kind of logo so people know it's us. So,
Bob and Ben.
We're going to have Bob and Ben simultaneously smoking the same pipe. How about that?
Yeah, we'll call it Bomb and Ben. Smoking a split pipe.
Yeah, that's right.
He's doing it.
Yeah, well, we've got an agent in Regina in Canada who's reciting J.H. Prynne over Edgar Varèse. Yeah.
Is that Ken? That Ken guy?
Yeah, it's Ken Fox. Ken. So we have an agent elsewhere.
Does he listen to our show?
He's learnt it all off us. Yeah, he's declared that he was very grateful to hear the first show because he likes to be in at the beginning of something revolutionary.
Great, and he's on our team?
I think so.
Wow. The thing
Bob,
is,
okay. Bob, we're reaching 55 minutes. I've got to thank you very much and finish this show. Have you got any last bon mot?
Praise Ken.
Good night.
Good night.